Chapter 7. The headphones clamped around Sloane's ears made her so sweaty that her hair felt glued to her skin. But to take them off to cool herself meant she had to endure the pounding throb of the helicopter's engine and rotor. It was a balance of discomforts that she'd endured for 2 fruitless days. The back of her shirt was also sticky. Every time she shifted position, it stuck to the vinyl seat. She'd learned early on to hold the shirt when she moved or it would tighten across her chest, gaining her a leering grin from Luca, who sat next to her on the rear bench seat. She would have preferred to sit in the front next to the pilot, but he said he needed Tony's weight in the cockpit to keep the small chopper in proper trim. They were returning to Svakopmund for the last time, for which Sloane was both grateful and frustrated. 7 times they'd flown out over the ocean and searched the spots circled on her map, and 7 times they'd returned to refuel, having found nothing but natural rock formations. The portable metal detector they could dip into the water on a long tether failed to find any metal source large enough to be an anchor, let alone an entire ship. Her body ached from so many hot hours in the cramped chopper, and she thought she'd never get Luca's body odor out of her nostrils. She had been so sure of her plan to use local fishermen's knowledge of the waters off the coast that she hadn't even considered failing. But now that they were returning to the little heliport in the dunes outside of Svakopmund, defeat scalded the back of her throat while the glare off the ocean below penetrated her sunglasses and made her head pound. Tony turned in his seat to look at her and motioned for her to jack her headphones back into the helicopter's internal communications net. She had unplugged it to give her pity party some privacy. "The pilot says that the chopper doesn't have the range to check that last spot on the map. The one we got from Papa Heinrich." "What's this about Papa Heinrich?" Luca asked, blasting Sloane with a dose of halitosis. Something had prevented Sloane from discussing their late-night raft trip down in Sandwich Bay to visit the crazy old fisherman, mostly because she grudgingly suspected that Luca had been right all along and just didn't want to admit it to the guide. Wishing Tony had kept his mouth shut, Sloane shrugged. "Doesn't matter. He was nuttier than a fruitcake. We've wasted more than $2,000 on fuel checking possibilities from reliable sources. I can't see us wasting any more on Papa Heinrich and his giant snakes." "Giant what?" the pilot asked. He was South African with a thick Afrikaans accent. "Giant snakes," Sloane repeated, feeling foolish. "He claims he was attacked by giant metal snakes."
"Most likely it was the DTs," the pilot said. "Everyone around here knows that Papa Heinrich is the world's biggest boozer. I've seen him drink a pair of Aussie backpackers under the table, and both those lads were the size of elephants. Rugby players, I think they were. If it's snakes he's seeing, you can bet your last rand he was coming off a binder when he saw them."
"Giant snakes," Luca giggled. "Did I not tell you that Papa Heinrich is a crazy man? You waste your time talking to him. You trust Luca. I find the spot you're looking for. You see, there are still places out here where it could be."
"Not for me," Tony said. "I have to be back home day after tomorrow, and I just want to sit by the pool."
"That is okay," Luca said with a quick glance at where Sloane's leg emerged from her shorts. "I take Miss Sloane alone in a boat with greater range than this helicopter."
"I don't think so," Sloane said sharply enough to get Tony's attention.
She glared at him, and it took him a moment to understand what their guide was really after.
"We'll play it by ear. See how I feel in the morning, huh?" he said. "Maybe a boat trip wouldn't be too bad."
"You're wasting your time," the pilot muttered.
Sloane was sure he was right. The chopper flared over the dusty heliport 20 minutes later. The rotor blast kicked up a cloud of grit that obscured the ground and turned the limp windsock into a rigid pink cone. The pilot gently set his helicopter on the ground and immediately cut the engines. The effect was instantaneous. The piercing whine of the motor faded and the blades began to slow. He opened his door before they stopped, exchanging the hot, sweat-tainted air in the cabin with hot, gritty air from outside. It was still a relief. Sloane opened her door and stepped from the helo, ducking low instinctively as the rotor continued to whirl over her head. She grabbed her duffel bag and then walked around the chopper's nose to give Tony a hand unhooking the metal detector and cable spool from the left skid. Together, they lugged the 100-pound piece of equipment to the back of the pickup they'd rented. Luca had made no offer to help and instead sucked furiously on his first cigarette in 2 hours. Tony settled up with the pilot for his day's service, depleting all but 2 of his traveler's checks, which he'd already vowed to lose at the casino in their hotel. The pilot shook hands with both of them, thanking them for using his charter service, and left with one last piece of advice.
"I'm sure you figured Luca's a rogue and a thief, but he's right about Papa Heinrich. That old man isn't right in the head. You two have had your bit of fun looking for a sunken ship. Enjoy the last day of your holiday. Go on a tour of the dunes or relax by the pool like Tony says."
With Luca safely out of earshot, Sloane replied,
"Pete, we've come halfway around the world. What's another wasted day?"
The pilot chuckled.
"That's what I love about you, Yanks. You never give up."
They shook hands again, and Luca scampered into the back of the four-wheel drive pickup. They dropped him in front of a bar in his working-class neighborhood along Walvis Bay. They paid him his daily wage, and despite their protestations that they probably wouldn't be needing him again, he promised to be at the hotel at 9 the next morning.
"God, he's insufferable," Sloane said. "I don't understand your problem with him. Yeah, he could use a shower and a breath mint, but he really has been helpful."
"Try being a woman around him and you'll understand."
Swakopmund was unlike any town in Africa. Because Namibia had been a German colony, the city's architecture was pure Bavaria, with lots of gingerbread trim on the houses and solid Lutheran churches. The palm-lined streets were wide and well-maintained, although sand from the desert blew across everything. With access to a deep-water port at Walvis Bay, it was becoming a cruise destination for the adventurous set. Sloane begged off Tony's suggestion of dinner at the hotel's buffet and a night at the casino.
"I think I'm going to the restaurant out by the lighthouse and watch the sun go down."
"Suit yourself," Tony said, and headed off for his room. After her shower, Sloane put on a floral print sundress and flats and draped a sweater over her shoulder. She let her copper hair flow free around her shoulders and used makeup to even out where the tops of her cheeks had been pinked by the sun. Although Tony had been a complete gentleman the entire trip, she had a premonition that tonight, after a couple hours of pretending to be James Bond in the casino, he would make a pass. Best to just not be around, was her attitude. She strolled down Bahnhof Street, peering in shop windows at native carvings and painted ostrich eggs for sale to the tourists. The wind coming off the Atlantic freshened the city and scoured the air of dust. When she reached the end of the street, Palm Beach was to her right and the Mole was straight ahead. The Mole was a natural spit of land that sheltered Palm Beach, and at its tip was a spindly lighthouse. She reached her destination a couple minutes later. Perched above the crashing surf, the restaurant had spectacular views. A number of tourists were there with the same idea as Sloane. She ordered a German beer from the bar and took it to a vacant seat overlooking the sea. Sloane McIntyre wasn't used to failure, so she was especially annoyed the trip had been a bust. True, it had been a long shot from the beginning, but she still thought they had a good chance at finding the HMS Rove. But then what, she asked herself for the 100th time, what were the chances that the rumor was true? 1,000 to 1? 1,000,000? And what would she get for finding it? A pat on the back and a bonus. She had to wonder if putting up with Tony's petulance and Luca's leers and Papa Heinrich's insanity was worth it. She downed the last of her beer in 3 angry gulps and ordered another plus a fish dinner. She ate as the sun sank into the sea, reflecting on her life. She had a sister with a husband, a career, and 3 kids, while she was in her London flat so infrequently she threw away all her real plants in favor of plastic ones because they always died of neglect. She thought about her last relationship and how it, too, had petered out because she was never around. But mostly she brooded on how a woman with a business degree from Columbia ends up spending her time traipsing around third-world countries questioning fishermen about where they lose their nets. She decided as she finished her meal that when she got home she was going to take a serious look at her life and what she wanted out of it. She'd be 40 in 3 years. And while that didn't sound old to her now, she remembered how ancient it seemed when she was 20. She was nowhere near her career goals and felt that she wasn't going to get much higher on the corporate ladder without some drastic action, which she'd thought she'd taken by coming to Namibia. But now this was turning out to be a bust, and her logic came full circle to being angry at herself for being so wrong. The air grew a bit chilly with the wind coming off the cold water. She shrugged into her sweater and paid her tab, leaving a generous tip even though her guidebook said waiters didn't expect one. She started back to her hotel, taking a different route than before just to see more of the old town. The sidewalks were quiet except around a couple of restaurants, and there was no traffic on the street. While wealthy by Africa's standards, Namibia was still a poor country, and people tended to live with the rhythms of the day. Most were asleep by 8, so there were few lights in the homes. Sloane became aware of the footsteps when the wind died suddenly. Without its gentle hiss, the tap of shoes on concrete carried easily. She turned and saw a shadow duck around a corner. Had the person kept coming, she would have considered the moment a figment of paranoia. But the person didn't want her to know he was there, and Sloane realized she wasn't all that familiar with this part of the city. She knew her hotel was to her left, 4, maybe 5 streets over. It dominated Bahnhof Street, so if she could reach that road, she'd be fine. She took off running, lost a sandal after only a couple of steps, and quickly kicked off the other as her pursuer gave a startled grunt at her reaction and started after her. Sloane ran as hard as she could, her bare feet slapping against the sidewalk. Just before she turned a corner, she chanced looking back. There were 2 of them. She thought they might have been a pair of the fishermen she and Tony had questioned, but she could tell both men were white and it looked like one of them had a pistol. She careened around the corner and ran even harder. They would gain on her, she knew, but if she could just reach the hotel, she was sure they'd back off. Her arms pumping, wishing she'd worn a sports bra rather than the lacy things she'd chosen, Sloane dashed across a side street. The men were momentarily out of view, so when she saw an alley, she dashed down it instinctively. She was almost at the end where it opened onto another road when she kicked a metal can she hadn't seen in the darkness. The pain of her stubbed toe was nothing compared to her fury at not seeing the can. It clanged like a rung bell, and as she emerged from the alley, she knew her pursuers had heard it too. She turned left once again and saw a car approaching. Sloane ran into the street, waving her arms over her head frantically. The car slowed. She could see a man and a woman inside, children in the back seat. The woman said something to her husband, and he looked away guiltily as he accelerated past her. Sloane cursed. She'd lost precious seconds hoping they would help. She ran again, her lungs beginning to burn. The crack of the pistol shot and the spray of concrete dust exploding off the building next to her struck Sloane at the same instant. The gunman had missed her head by less than a foot. She fought the instinct to duck, which would have slowed her pace, and continued to sprint like a gazelle, weaving right and left with sharp movements to throw off their aim. She saw a sign for Wasserfall Street and knew she was only half a block from her hotel. She put on a burst of speed she never thought she was capable of and emerged onto Bahnhof Street. Her hotel was almost directly ahead, and a string of cars cruised down the wide lane. There were plenty of lights around the old converted train station. She danced through traffic, ignoring the honks, and finally reached the hotel's entrance. She turned back. The two men lurked across the street, glaring at her. The shooter had hidden his pistol under his jacket. He cupped his hands to his mouth and shouted, "This was a warning. Leave Namibia or the next time I won't miss." A spark of defiance compelled Sloane to want to give him the finger, but all she could do was slump to the ground as tears welled in her eyes and her chest convulsed. A doorman approached her a moment later.
"Are you okay, miss?"
"I'm fine," Sloane said, getting to her feet and dusting her backside. She knuckled the moisture from her eyes. The spot where the men had stood was deserted. Even though her lips still quivered and her legs felt like gel, Sloane squared her shoulders, deliberately raised her right arm, and then extended her middle finger.